You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 11. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Welcome to another episode of the Tricorder Transmissions. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett
and Craig Cohen, and this week we will be talking about The Menagerie Part 1. And a programming note, since this is part 1 of a two-part episode, we will be holding off a week to give our essential vote. We will vote essential for Part 1 and Part 2 combined.
Yeah. And before we jump into the episode, as always, we're going to jump into some news. And there's quite a few things going on this week in Trek news, and I'll start off by talking about New York Comic Con.
Yeah,
so there's some Trek going on in New York Comic Con. You know, William Shatner is going to be there, but we talked about that before. And then one of the interesting things I've seen this week is that, you know, Comic Con is famous for having exclusive merchandise that is only available at Comic Con.
Yes, drives and, collectors crazy,
yeah,
I'm sure.
And this year, it's driving me crazy.
Oh, no.
Because, yeah. So, there's a series of Kirk t-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three of them, to be exact. And they are Star Trek II sort of homage t-shirts with a still shot, a hand-drawn still shot of Kirk screaming Khan, right?
Mm-hmm.
But instead of screaming Khan, he screams other things. One is fluffy kittens, and he has a group of kittens in his hand. Another is muffins, and he's a group of muffins in his hand. But the coolest one is the third one, which is only available on the show floor at Comic-Con at the booth, and he screams Comic-Con with the word Khan instead of C-O-N. And I'm going to tell you right now, man, I would really love to have that shirt, and I'm really bummed that I'm not going to be able to go to Comic-Con and get a hold of that shirt for myself,
mm-hmm.
and I'm damn sure not going to pay an eBay price for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you reached out to friend of the show, John Jay?
I thought about it, but I didn't know the etiquette. I may reach out to him. I wasn't sure, you know, if that's a proper thing to do. The shirts are $25, and I really have no way of getting him the money ahead of time, so I don't know what the etiquette would be.
You guys don't have PayPal?
That's a good point. I didn't think of that.
Yeah. Hey, man, I'm saying, if you want that shirt, you have to make it happen.
You are you are just full of good ideas today. I'm telling you. You're full. So, you know what? I'm going to jump ahead in the news. Now I'm gonna take this offline, and I'll reach out to Mr. J via Twitter and find out if he'll partake in this little plot to get me a shirt. So another really awesome yet knife-twisting bit of Star Trek cool news is that there is a brand new line of die-cast models of Star Trek ships,
cool,
launching this month by a company by the name of Eagle Moss. I'm sure they have some sort of reputation. I don't think I've heard of them before, but then again, I'm not a really huge model or toy collector. But from what I understand, they've have some notoriety. And the rub, if you're waiting for the rub, is that each die-cast model is being released on a two-week basis. So every 2 weeks they're releasing another one. And they are tied into a magazine subscription.
Oh,
$20 a pop. So,
and what are the magazines?
They're Trek-related magazines, but you're talking 40 bones a month now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and here's the real big kicker that kind of made me eye roll. And believe me, I was really debating subscribing to this thing. but they plan to have as many as 70 issues.
Oh, see, nah, it's...
So you're on the hook for what, 1,400 bones?
Oh my God, for, yeah.
And it's a lot, and they're little 6-inch models, and the pictures they have are awesome. They have 9 planned versions of the Enterprise.
Goodness.
How cool is that? I mean, and they have all sorts of ships. Things have never been made before that mm-hmm. they're making. I mean, every alien race's ships are represented here. So you're getting, you know, Romulan birds of prey, Klingon birds of prey. You're getting Ferengi ships, Cardassian ships. If you're into Next Gen and DS9, something in it for everybody. You know, the Enterprise NX1 models, you got all different versions of the Enterprise from the movies, from the shows. I mean, they're all in there. I was so tempted, but when I saw the sheer amount of content here and the fact that you just can't pick and choose the ones you want, you're kind of stuck subscribing and you know, just kind of going along for the ride. It just seems like a heck of a lot of money to invest for me. And I know a lot of fans will probably say, but, you know, I'm just feeling really, you know, nervous about jumping in with that much money.
Oh, I don't blame you, man. I mean, I never really thought that a person's fandom of anything, be it music, TV show, movie, anything, should be tied into the amount of swag or merchandise they purchase related to that movie, band, TV show.
Oh, I agree with that completely.
You know,
I agree with that completely, man. You know, I have Star Trek stuff, you know, and I have the things that I have are things that I really like and things that I really wanted. So, you know, that's just the way I am. And I know there's people out there who are real completists who want to get everything, but I don't think that you can say that anyone's more or less of a fan by the amount of money they want to invest in.
No, I mean, and that's the beauty of fandom of any kind is you can take it as far as you want, and people do.
Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree. So moving on, this is also the 46th anniversary of the Mirror Mirror episode.
Ooh, which that contributed so much. And I'm sure when we get to that episode, we'll talk about it.
Huge.
But that contributed so much to the overall Star Trek lore.
Oh, absolutely.
I think every series that followed did a Mirror episode.
Just about.
Yeah, I don't know. Enterprise did, yes.
Yeah, I don't think Voyager though.
All right, yeah.
I think
Voyager kind of makes sense because they really weren't in a position to, I guess. Yeah, well, they were kind of out of the galaxy.
Yeah, well, hey, you know, they had holodecks. They had holodecks. So there's no excuse. But anyway, to commemorate the 46th anniversary, there are 3 prints being released in honor. One is of Kirk and Spock. One is Spock at a console on the bridge, and another is Spock and his mirror self on opposite sides.
Nice. And who's doing these prints?
Oh, that's a really good question. I didn't write that down. I'll put it in the show notes, though.
All right. No, that's cool. I wasn't sure if it was like, you know, Juan Ortiz or something.
No,
like
it's
that.
Not Juan.
He seems to be on fire lately.
Not Juan. Although his shot glasses are coming out.
Oh, nice.
A little note about those, but I'll put it in the show notes, a link to it. And let's see. Oh, next, yet another new batch of Star Trek toys is coming out. This one is from a recent expo called iHobby. And the most interesting thing is there's a couple of models of ships and, you know, a new phaser and tricorder. But the cool thing that I saw amongst that group of toys is a original series bridge playset with all of the original series major characters represented in the model. So I'm going to be looking into getting that when that's officially released.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, we had the Mego dolls and the bridge that they could all sort of sit in.
Yeah, this one looks to be like a scale model replica.
Wow.
Yeah, all, you know, 360 degree, the entire bridge laid out exactly as it was on the show. Yeah, with all the accoutrements, the chairs are in the proper places, all that kind of thing. Looks pretty cool. Once again, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Excellent. And weren't you really excited about a CD coming out this week?
Yes, and perfect segue. That was my next note. So, unfortunately, my CD has not arrived yet, but the Shatner album, Ponder the Mystery, has been released. It was released on Tuesday. And so far, I listened to all the iTunes previews. As interesting as I thought it would be, a little bit different, but it is a prog rock album. So,
and what is this like, not counting the Transformed Man or whatever that album was in the late 60s?
Yep.
This is what, like his fourth or fifth solo album in the last 10 years?
Well, let's see. So this is the third in the last 10
years.
That's
still a lot for a guy who's, you know, 84 years old.
Yeah, man. So you had Has Been, which was with Ben Folds. And you had Seeking Major Tom, which was a double album.
Yeah.
Which was kind of like a sci-fi concept record, which I is really fun to listen to. And this one is a prog rock album featuring, you know, some of the big prog rock names, you know, Rick Wakeman. And,
I was going to say, if Rick Wakeman isn't on it, then it can't be considered prog rock.
Yep. yeah. So Shatner's doing a little tour. We talked about that last week. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting listen so far with the samples that I've heard. I'm anxious to get a hold of the CD and do a full talk about it in an upcoming episode once I get a chance to digest the whole thing. So keep an eye out, or an ear rather.
Yeah, maybe we could do a whole supplemental episode based on all of the recorded work.
Yeah, that's a really great idea. Yeah. That's a really great idea. So we could
really
go down
that rabbit hole for people.
Yeah, that could be an interesting discussion. So that about wraps it up for the news in the Trek universe for the week. Ready to jump through some air dates and the episode synopsis?
Yes.
All right.
The Menagerie Part 1.
So the Menagerie Part 1 first aired on the 17th of November in 1966. And strangely enough, the remastered version aired on the 25th of November 2006.
Yeah, and they actually put this pretty close to its normal scheduled sort of placement in the original series remastered run. It was released 12th in the remastered format when it was originally number 11.
Pretty cool, man.
Yeah. It's still, you know, kind of curious what the rhyme or reason was for how they remastered it. Maybe one day before we are done with this podcast, we will find out that answer.
Yeah, because we've been saying that for a while now.
Yes.
We'll get to it. Uh-huh. We promise.
So I found the TV Guide listing from November 12th.
Oh, wow.
Of 1966 for this episode, and it includes the following write-up. In the first of a two-part story, Spock inexplicably abducts crippled Captain Pike, the Enterprise's former commander, locks the spaceship on a course for the only forbidden planet in the galaxy, and then turns himself in for court-martial.
Wow.
So imagine opening up your TV Guide on November 12th and reading that, and then having to wait until the 17th.
You know, that's a really great short synopsis.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You know, I'm going to try and dig up, you know, different sources for these show rundowns as we progress.
Yep, this one turned out great, so I'm looking forward to some more. So, you ready to count us in?
Sure thing. We will start our discussion of The Menagerie Part 1 in 3, 2, 1. So, basically, you find yourself in a position where you have this episode of a show that is fully produced, filmed, written, filmed, fully produced with special effects, and you don't air it.
Yep. The unaired pilot. Well, at this time, unaired pilot. Yeah, it did actually air
20 years later.
Yeah, in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. So you basically got the creator sitting on this, and there was, from what I understand, a little bit of a script crunch and some budget concerns.
Yep. From what I understand, they were running low on scripts mid-season. So Robert Justman came up with the idea of taking the original Cage pilot and creating a two-parter out of it. And they actually offered this episode to the original director of the Cage, Robert Butler.
Yeah.
But he refused because he didn't like the series. So,
yeah. But he is credited.
Yep.
This is the only two-part episode in Star Trek the Original Series history.
Yep.
Each credit or each episode is credited to a different director. Yeah. I believe, and let me get my notes straight here, you had Butler, or actually Mark Daniels directed the framing story. And since most of his footage was used in part one, he was given directing credit for the episode we're watching. And Robert Butler was given credit for part two because most of that footage was from the original pilot. It's interesting because Mark Daniels was a pretty big-time director. He died in 1989, but before that, he directed the first 38 episodes of I Love Lucy.
Wow.
And also directed 15 Trek episodes.
Jeez.
So he also directed The Man Trap, The Naked Time, which are both episodes we've talked about already, Court Martial, Space Seed, which is one of the most legendary Star Trek episodes, Who Mourns for Adonis, The Changeling, Mirror, The Doomsday Machine, which I know we both can't wait to talk about.
Yeah. Here's the Pike reveal, by the way.
Oh, yeah, there's
the Pike reveal. So Kirk was unaware that this had happened to Pike.
Yes.
And also another quick note before we move on is that what we didn't talk about at the very beginning of this episode is the first time that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy beam down without a security team.
Oh, very interesting.
Of course, they're beaming into a star base.
Yes.
So they probably wouldn't need security. But at any rate,
this is actor Sean Kinney playing Pike. In the original footage, we will see another actor, Jeffrey Hunter. And we'll get into why he is not in this footage.
Yeah, but, that's the iconic wheelchair that they created for the incapacitated Captain Pike. That's been actually made the rounds on other TV shows. You've seen homages to that. I think Futurama did one, and there are a couple of other ones.
There was actually a Star Trek documentary a couple years ago that was theatrical. It was hosted by Tasha Yar from The Next Generation. I forgot her name, the actress.
Yeah.
And I think it was called Trekkies, and it kind of focused on fandom. Mm-hmm. And one of the fans had built a functional version of this.
Oh, I think I heard about this.
And he, there's footage in the movie of him driving down the street.
I think I've seen that.
And it had the lights, the one blink for yes and two blinks for no or vice versa. So we learned a lot of information here. We learned that prior to Kirk being captain of the Enterprise, Chris Pike was captain and Spock served as his first officer. So, and at some point his command ended and Kirk took command of the Enterprise, and everybody went on their way until it's discovered that Pike is in this new condition, and it drives Spock to do a pretty shocking thing.
Yes, it certainly does. So I always had a question about Pike's wheelchair. Maybe you can help settle this for me.
All right.
Is he pooping there? I mean, really, it has to go somewhere.
Yeah, I think at this point, Pike's probably hooked up to a bag or something.
So there's got to be something they use to clean it out, I guess. They plugs it into something.
He's not wearing a diaper
or
anything.
That's an awesome night shot of the Starbase, by the way.
Yeah.
Great. There's one of those... one of those fast food ordering things. It looks like a microphone there on Mendez's desk, and a whole array of memory tapes there, all different colors. But none of them have any labels on them. You ever notice all those memory tapes? How do they know what's on those?
Yeah, I don't
know. They didn't have like a Brother P-Touch in the future?
Right.
Couldn't P-Touch a label on that those things?
Maybe there's like a little braille style indicator where you rub your thumb over it or something and you get a...
Yeah.
You're able to read what tape it is.
So having a cool disagreement here between Kirk and Mendez.
Yeah. And it's neat. Mendez has a different emblem on his shirt.
And he has different sleeve insignias, too. So he's of a higher rank than Kirk.
Yeah. But it didn't seem to me like in the Star Trek universe, the patch on the front of your shirt indicated much of anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, as the series went on, I think that indicated, in Next Generation, it was on your collar.
Yep. You had the dots, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I always just thought they sort of had that Starfleet insignia.
Mm-hmm.
On the shirt.
Well, I think isn't Mendez a flag officer? Isn't he like really higher in rank?
Yeah,
he's an admiral, or is he even higher than that?
Yeah.
So now we see Spock creeping in.
Yeah.
To rig up some stuff on the computers here. So another thing that I was going to pose to you is that we know that Pike can say yes with one blink and no with two blinks, right? So when Spock reveals to Pike what his intentions are, Pike keeps saying no, 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 right? Is Pike saying no because he doesn't want Spock to risk his career, or is he saying no because he doesn't want to go to Talos IV?
I think it's because he doesn't want Spock to
that's what I'm leaning towards,
make the
too.
Sacrifice that he's making.
But, you know,
because we basically learn that going to this planet,
mm-hmm.
if you go to this planet, it's against Federation orders.
Yep.
It's the death sentence.
We're going to get into that. Yep.
Yeah.
We are. And it just was a thought that had occurred to me when I was thinking about this, because I know that, you know, he and you'll find out more and more in this episode that Pike and Spock had a relationship, and, you know, Spock, I guess against his Vulcan nature, deeply cares about Pike,
mm-hmm.
you know, as he cares about Kirk, and, you know, he's willing to risk his career for him. But I wanted to believe that Pike was looking out for Spock's best interests. But then again, there was part of me that wondered, he knew about Talos having been there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he wasn't okay with it. Maybe he wasn't okay with being there. I don't know. But
well, and that's what sort of brings up the interesting discussion and the fact that the cage sort of is diametrically opposed to the menagerie, in the sense that the sort of idea it puts forward,
yep.
Is sort of looked upon in one way in the cage,
mm-hmm.
and then a different way in the menagerie. So it's almost like the menagerie discounts the events of the cage. And if that's the case, you'd say, okay, the things that Pike sort of believes, or his belief system in the cage,
yep.
Isn't really true.
That, and I don't think it's really even I think they cut it out for this episode, but the Talosians at the end of the pilot said that they found humans were not suitable
mm-hmm.
for their means. So why would they want Pike back anyway? They can't use
exactly.
them to mm-hmm. repopulate. But I guess we're meant to believe that the Talosians have some sort of an emotional attachment to Pike
yeah.
after mm-hmm. what they put him through.
Yeah.
But one has to wonder, the Talosians do say their race is doomed to extinction. So will Pike really have a long rest mm-hmm. of his life mm-hmm. there? I mean,
that's why I think that you can't really take anything that the cage presents as canon.
mm-hmm.
Especially considering that they, you know, the menagerie borrows footage from it and repurposes it and puts it into a different light.
Spock
here we have
is
another,
brutal here. Look at them taking those punches.
Yeah. And
nerve pinch. Boom. Yeah.
That's like the second nerve pinch we've seen.
Yeah. And Spock really took those punches well. So that I guess that's a good indication of what Vulcans are capable of sustaining physically.
Yeah. We haven't seen anybody take a punch like that since Mrs. Crater in The Man Trap.
Yeah, it's not Nancy Bones. That's for sure. But see, he's using these memory tapes now to mimic orders, right? And he uses them to mimic Kirk's voice too, mm-hmm. doesn't he? So
yeah.
he's really putting Kirk in a tough spot.
Oh yeah.
Really putting Kirk mm-hmm. in a tough spot.
But I think that's one of the sort of strongest aspects of this episode. This two-part episode is, you know, that Spock as a Vulcan does everything based on logic.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of his personal feelings towards Pike, he still is logically making a decision to do what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a viewer, and sort of as the you know, the judges, Kirk and the other two,
Mendez,
they all know that this is the level that Spock operates from. So you're waiting for that reveal to, you know, how can we get out of this? How can Spock not get sent to death?
And right here, you're going to be, you're seeing McCoy and Kirk not wanting to believe, because Spock's the only one that heard the transmission.
Yeah.
They don't want to believe that Spock is capable of something like this, because it's something completely alien for Spock. It's something that's totally out of his realm of normal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to believe that Spock is responsible for setting up this elaborate ruse, that would be a big leap for them.
Yeah.
So I think that speaks a lot to their rapport with Spock and their deep relationship, you know, professionally and on a personal level. So Spock's integrity usually stands ahead of him.
Yeah.
Whatever situations they wind them, they're going to have a little bit of an argument too about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things you wonder is why the cage was ultimately finally released. And I think it was a matter of, they actually finally found a complete, you know, 16 millimeter, copy of it. But you'd almost think that there was really no financial benefit for them back in 86, 88, whenever that the cage was released finally. Whereas you think if they had discovered it today, God, it would have probably been a theatrical presentation. You know, a Blu-ray release, you know, I mean, they really could have monetized it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they're just not long ago, we went to see, they released as a special event in theaters,
The Next Generation.
The Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2 in the theater. And of course, I'm going to go see it. So we went to see it. It was great to see it in the theater, and they had a little documentary in the beginning. It was really cool. They would have done the same type of thing with the cage, but wasn't the Next Generation ramping up, getting pretty popular in the late 80s?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it kind of made sense for them to dig it out then, because Star Trek was having kind of a revival with the Next Generation back on television.
Yeah.
After getting a... Oh, here we go with the... just to take a quick aside, here's the Talos IV booklet here that Mendez is going to show Kirk, you know, pretty much banning travel or contact with Talos IV. And, you know, what strikes me as odd is that when, if you watch the cage and realize what had happened and how that pilot wraps, you wouldn't think that Talos IV would be as forbidden as it apparently is, because the Talosians say that they're pretty much near death. Their civilization is over. They have no further interest in humanity anymore. So the only thing I can think of is that maybe after hearing Pike's report of what the Talosians are capable of, maybe they thought that people would want to go there to take the powers for themselves. I don't know. Okay, so Pike just disappeared, by the way.
But see, that's part of the reason I think that you can't trust the cage.
No, I agree.
In the context of the menagerie. It almost seems like the cage has to exist in a vacuum. And as soon as it doesn't, it immediately becomes invalid.
It calls too many things into question. So maybe you kind of have to look at it like the original series versus the Star Trek 2009 reboot. Almost like, okay, the original series existed in its own. So this timeline now in the new one's a different timeline. The two are not, the events of both are two completely different, disconnected things. So you're right. I think you have to leave the pilot itself behind and buy into what the images, the re-edited and cut images that you get from the cage in this particular context. So I'm going to have to try to minimize my referencing the actual pilot.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not easy to do because when it's there and it's accessible, it's hard. You know, it's hard not to look at it and consider it. I think it's actually included on the Blu-ray on the end of season 3.
Mm.
So I think it's actually considered episode 80 of the original series, whereas the original series ran for 79 episodes, and the cage is considered number 80. And
so McCoy now knows that Spock has snuck Captain Pike onto the Enterprise, and he's going to ask McCoy to keep quiet, kind of, you know, about the route, because Spock has taken the ship out of orbit, right? Or is taking the ship out of orbit, and he's going to leave Captain Kirk back on the starbase with Mendez.
Yeah.
So Spock's setup for this is extremely elaborate, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
So he's got forged voice tapes. He's rigged computers and ship's controls, right, to his own ends, and he fakes official Starfleet orders. So, you know, this is yet another way someone can take over the Enterprise, right?
Yeah.
You'd have to be highly intelligent and have a crazy level of access to the ship to do this, but you could do it. And you know, another side note about General Order 7. So we talked about General Order 7, which is the only capital crime on the Starfleet books, the only crime punishable by the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And in all of the original series, this is the only time it's applied.
Mm-hmm.
Violating the neutral zone treaty doesn't even bring about the death penalty, does it?
No, I don't.
No. So here we see the Kirk and Mendez are flying via shuttlecraft to try to catch up to the Enterprise. It's the shuttle Picasso. Mm. So there's many different, over the years, many different shuttlecrafts. We'll see Copernicus, and soon we'll see the Galileo, right?
Yeah.
So is this the first time we're seeing the inside of a shuttlecraft?
I believe so, yeah. I mean,
believe it is.
This might be the first time we're actually seeing a shuttlecraft because... What was the episode where Sulu was stranded on that planet in below zero weather?
Oh, man.
We covered
the Naked Time.
Naked Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't even mention of the shuttlecraft.
Right, and you would think they could have just flown the thing down and picked him up.
Yeah, yeah. So... The shuttlecraft was definitely somewhat...
Oh, no, it wasn't the Naked Time. It was the Enemy Within.
Okay, yeah.
Because they would get duplicated if they poured it back out. Wow, that was
the transporter because,
brain fart, memory lapse.
Yeah. Well, those episodes feel kind of like kindred spirits because they both deal with sort of the dual nature of man.
So at this point, Spock has essentially commandeered the Enterprise to his own ends and is actively trying to fool the rest of the crew into complicity with this. So he's faked an order from Starfleet, and he's gotten everybody to buy into it. And it's almost an unthinkable act for Spock, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. If any other character was doing it,
you'd
assume that. Oh, okay, this is their last episode of the series.
Yeah, they're going to be done after this. But you know, this is a fairly major character at this point in the series. If you've been watching the whole time, you've got a pretty good feel for who Spock is, what he's about, and this is a big turnabout for him. So this is pretty serious. So you know, Mendez already has it in for Spock. I think he's already pretty much made up his mind. You know, Spock has got to go.
Yeah.
And I think they're running out of juice at this point, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think the shuttlecraft is almost dead in the water, or dead in space, rather.
Yeah, the shuttlecrafts aren't really designed to do any kind of deep...
No, they're short range, you know, ship-to-surface or ship-to-ship transport devices. In fact, and they aren't used too often. You know, in the wake of the transporters, of course, they usually could transport wherever they wanted to go. But, you know, there's times where the transporter won't work or, you know, they need to take a shuttlecraft down.
I can almost imagine the scenario where the transporter technology was on the horizon and the company that had the contract to build the shuttlecrafts was probably getting very nervous. So they were probably potentially sabotaging some of the transporter trials.
Could you imagine?
You know, running internal Starfleet advertisements selling why shuttlecrafts were still the bee's knees.
Yeah. It's kind of like the old the oil company trying to kill the electric car, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Self-preservation.
Yeah, I wonder if there's potential for a little fan fiction to go on there.
So now, is the shuttlecraft that's dying in space throwing a monkey wrench into Spock's plans, or is this playing right into his plan?
I think Spock moved ahead and said either scenario is doable.
Yep.
Ideally, I'd like to just get to the planet and do what we need to do. But if not, I know that there's logic will see its way through, and it might take a little bit more time than I'd like. But yeah, I don't think this was anticipated by Spock, but I think he basically knew that if it did happen.
So now he's submitting himself for arrest.
Yes.
For mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I like to think back to this previous question. I like to think to myself that, you know, when you see Spock play the 3D chess game, he's always thought about, 20 moves in advance. So I'd like to think he had both of these scenarios written out in his own mind and how he was going to proceed. But it's interesting here when they order them to transport Captain Kirk from the shuttlecraft onto the Enterprise. He's going to say beam Captain Kirk aboard. He doesn't mention Mendez at all. So at this point, does Spock already know about Mendez? That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Because if Spock has already worked out this entire thing with the Talosians, he may already be aware of Mendez's role in this entire thing.
Yeah. Well, I think if nothing else, he knew that there had to be a certain amount of high-ranking Starfleet officials.
Right.
To present his case.
But are they all real, is the question.
Oh.
Did he already realize,
Wow.
Because if you think about it, I mean, he's already got the whole deal worked out, theoretically, with the Talosians, right? Because the Talosians have been working with Spock and...
But how?
That's Spock, man.
Some space frequencies of some
sort? No, that's Spock.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Spock somehow made contact with them, or they somehow made contact with Spock. And it's a plan. I mean, he's got the whole thing worked out. I mean, he had the ship locked down, to his own controls. And nobody can unlock these controls but Spock. So, and he's got the broadcasts that are going to be coming from Talos 4. So he had to have this whole thing pre-planned in advance, at least with the Talosians, to have them be able to send these transmissions to the Enterprise. So, it stands to reason that he may already be aware of what we will find out about Mendez eventually in the following episode. So now Spock has set himself up for a court-martial. I think this is the preliminary hearing, right?
Yeah.
This is where he's going to insist on being immediate court-martial without the preliminary hearing.
Yeah.
This is one of those clipboard things with the flashing lights on it. I don't know if I ever really noticed that the lights alternatingly flash like
that. Yeah.
So that had to take batteries, because they can pick those up and move those around. So those had to be, created and some sort of battery power.
Oh, yeah.
The props themselves. Which I wonder how much one of those would go for if you could find one of those original clipboard-type props.
Thousands?
Guy, absolutely.
Probably thousands.
I can't remember where I was seeing it. I saw something about an actual, set used... I think it was on one of the documentaries on the Blu-ray that there was an actual production used phaser that had gone for some insane amount of money, insane amount of money, tens of thousands. So And here we are, the official court-martial with yet another unmarked memory tape to record things.
Yeah, and now we have the dress uniform.
Yep, the formal uniforms.
Yeah.
And they bring Captain Pike in, and we found out that Pike was never demoted in rank at all. They
couldn't.
Sentimental reasons, they kept him in on the active duty roster. Yeah.
Say what you want about Starfleet.
They're sentimental.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they didn't hang him out to dry.
Yeah, this is the of course, the all we know right now about Starfleet is that humans and Vulcans are in it. Right?
Yeah.
We don't know anybody else that's currently in Starfleet from what we've seen. So it makes sense that there's some humanish traditions. But look at the weird little triangles that are on Kirk's shirt there.
And
they're in a different configuration than on Mendes.
Must be captain, and then that is actually, I have the, I guess the eight, maybe the 8 to 10 inch figure of Kirk that I have is Kirk in the dress uniform. It's actually right above me.
And Spock has a dress uniform on as well.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're seeing introductory footage of what we will know eventually as the cage, the pilot.
Uh-huh. We're basically watching the opening shot from the cage.
Yep.
And then it's wondered how we are watching this footage.
Yep. So as we just saw at the beginning of this court-martial sequence, Spock's knowledge of Starfleet regulations is very, very in-depth. So much that even, I guess Mendes is a Commodore, I think.
Okay.
Commodore Mendes even admits that whatever Spock is up to, he's got it planned out pretty damn well. So, you know, and he sort of, Spock manipulates this this hearing and Mendes in such a way that he allows for this video footage to be brought in as evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it would not normally have been allowed, except he kind of made Mendes open up the floor to it, as the video is now an answer to Mendes' questions for explanations.
Yeah, and it's a really sort of clever framing device.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, from what I've researched, the script for these two episodes was only 64 pages long, mainly because it used. This footage from the cage.
Yep, and as we were talking about before we started recording today, I think that this use of the cage footage is far superior to the actual cage episode itself. Mm-hmm. I think presenting it in this context is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I think it makes for a fantastic episode. You get a lot of really good history, and I guess you have to try to overlook the fact that number one and Nurse Chapel look a hell of a lot alike.
Yeah, and also that Spock looks different.
A bit.
Yeah.
But you could say he was younger at the time. You know, this is what, how many years difference?
It had to be
10 or 15
probably
years.
Probably close to a decade, yeah.
Yeah. Or 13. Oh, 13 years, I think Spock's is 13 years previously. So Spock's eyebrows have changed configuration in 13 years.
Well, and that's the crazy thing about this, is all sorts of things had to happen in order for us to get to the point where they're making the Menagerie Part 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
They had to film the pilot. The pilot had to be deemed not good enough or unworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Most times, that's it.
Yep.
The show's,
that's the death knell right there. Boom, done.
But the network said, we kind of like where you're going with this.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to the drawing board and come back.
Yep. I think rumor has it that Lucille Ball played a huge role in getting a second pilot made. She believed in the concept. She liked the concept. Mm-hmm. So she pushed for another a pilot to be made. Mm-hmm.
And then they had to get in a situation where they were under this script crunch and whatever kind of budget constraints. And Roddenberry, along with, you know, I guess Justman consulting him, you know, comes up with this sort of way to frame or to reuse the footage from the cage. I mean, it's amazing because you watch it and think about it in that sense and say, wow.
Yep.
This wasn't planned. This was sort of just a the way events unfolded. I mean, yep. Historically, you can look back and say it looks like everything fit together exactly the way it was supposed to, you know. Yep. But this was a puzzle that wasn't put together until it was,
you know,
dismantled. I mean, it's
one thing that does call into question for me, and this is not necessarily a Cage versus Menagerie thing, but if you think about what we're looking at, so, you know, Kirk, the famous monologue, the 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds. Now, we're seeing the Enterprise 13 years ago. What were they doing then? Were they exploring strange new worlds then? So there's a 5-year mission now, but now we're finding out the Enterprise has been around a hell of a lot longer than this 5-year mission is concerned. So what was the mission back then, I wonder?
Yeah.
They were just kind of flying around aimlessly, or you know, why did they go to, why were they out near the Talos star system anyway?
Yeah. And another question is Spock really not that good of a Starfleet officer where he wouldn't have been promoted?
That's a good question as well. But I think we can kind of explain that away. And there's a couple of times during the series where he'll mention that he's not interested in command.
Yeah.
He has said that several times, even though he does eventually wind up becoming Captain Spock in the movies.
Yeah.
Down the road. But there's a few times, at least that I can remember offhand, during the original series where he insists that he's not interested in having his own command.
Mm-hmm. I think any way you look at it, utilizing the footage from the Cage the way they did creates some kind of continuity problems.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
It does. And continuity problems outside of the Cage pilot versus Menagerie. Mm-hmm. So you have some, it calls into question some things about, you know, the nature of the 5-year mission and the previous use of the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Enterprise is apparently now, it's quite an older ship than we might have been led to believe originally, right?
Yeah.
So, and we've known that other people have piloted and lived on this ship before. So how old is the Enterprise really?
Yeah.
Prior to the Cage? Is this the Enterprise, is Pike the Enterprise's first captain?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, but if we read back into the lore, the stuff that's, you know, been written about Star Trek, I think Pike was actually the first captain.
Well, so where does Archer from Enterprise fit in?
I think they break canon on that, don't they? Or they changed it.
Yeah,
back,
you know,
back then, I guess he was the first one, and then I guess
Enterprise takes place, what, 50 years before?
But that's also a different Enterprise, isn't it? Archer's Enterprise is a different ship. It doesn't look, it's a different configuration of ship. Because if there's an episode of Enterprise that we're gonna talk about eventually, because it does tie back where they do find it's a mirror episode where they somehow are able to capture an Enterprise class ship. I think it was the Defiant or the Reliant, but it was a different configuration ship. It was the original series Enterprise as opposed to the Enterprise. So the ship actually looks different. So the original, quote unquote, the original Enterprise that Archer flies is a model that was developed before this original series model of Enterprise. And this one is apparently much more powerful according to that Enterprise episode. This class of ship is incredibly, the weapon systems and defensive capabilities of these ships far exceed Archer's Enterprise. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I'm very, very unfamiliar with Enterprise, aside from the weird theme song.
That really turned me off. I can admit that I've only watched a handful of episodes from the first season, and I've watched the complete third and fourth seasons at the insistence of another friend of mine who told me that the third and fourth seasons were, quote-unquote, where it got good. So I had to watch them because there are some original series references in the third and fourth seasons, especially the fourth, where they do the mirror thing, which is really cool.
And the theme song was sort of like a country.
I got faith of the heart.
Yeah. Very, very weird.
Wow. That when I watched the opening, the broadcast, that first episode, I actually questioned whether or not I was watching the right show. I'm like, is this really it? Is this And, you know, then you see the title come up, like, wow, this is it.
Yeah.
But at any rate.
Yeah.
So where were we at? So we've kind of concluded the first video transmission from Talos IV, and we're they're debating whether or not to move on. Mm-hmm. And so Spock, it seems, is the first officer to be tried in any sort of criminal proceeding in this series.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And he won't be the last.
Yeah.
He won't be the last. We're going to see a couple of other major characters being brought up on some sort of charges or being part of criminal investigations. And it'll also extend out into the movies. So we'll see Kirk and McCoy are part of a criminal Klingon criminal proceeding. So we're going to see a couple of other characters in upcoming shows, though, go through the same type of a process.
Yeah. So I think maybe we should talk a little bit about Jeffrey Hunter at this point.
Okay.
The actor who played Chris Pike. And basically, Jeffrey Hunter had the option to not come back for the second pilot. And he decided to focus on his movie career.
Mm-hmm.
And basically said, nah, go ahead without me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess not understanding the historical significance that Star Trek would achieve.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a kind of tragic scenario, Jeffrey Hunter died in 1969.
Yeah.
You could almost argue that had he stayed on and done Star Trek,
he probably would have lived because he died in an onset accident.
Yeah, right? The results from that, yeah. But we also might not be sitting here talking about Star Trek.
Entirely true.
You can only imagine what direction that series might have run one season, and that would have been it.
Yeah. So we'll hold off until you're done. I have some stuff I would interject on that.
Yeah. So he was in Spain filming a movie called Viva America in 69 when he was injured on set. It was an on-set explosion where he suffered facial lacerations.
Wow.
From broken glass as well as powder burns, which kind of really mirrors the facial damage that Pike has in this episode. So basically, he never really recovered from that. He was semi-paralyzed. Back in the U.S., he went to the hospital and suffered a cerebral hemorrhage. He recovered from that, but then a couple of weeks later, he was still complaining of headaches and dizziness. And he had another cerebral hemorrhage after falling a couple of flights of stairs in his living room. And that's where he was found. They were attempting to repair his skull, and he never regained consciousness, and he died at the age of 42.
Wow.
So, rough. Pike kind of plays a small role in Trek history, but Jeffrey Hunter is far more essential to the history of Star Trek than Pike ever could be, because you really create these what-if scenarios. If the cage had been picked up as the pilot they decided to run with, or if he decided to come back and do the second pilot.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It could have been very different. Yeah. So
I think we have a smile from Spock here.
Yep, there it is.
Very uncharacteristic.
The uncharacteristic. Spock was a happier guy back then. So, you know, we've watched The Cage. You know, I've seen it. You've seen it. You know, and I've said it before, you know, not on the podcast, but I think, I don't think that Star Trek would have met the success that it did if this crew was the crew that went into the actual production version of Star Trek. I don't think that this crew gels very well. I don't think the characters are as dynamic or memorable. Maybe if given the opportunity, they could have developed into something.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't... Not to say that Pike couldn't be a cool captain. I just don't see him as being as dynamic a guy as Shatner, as Kirk would be.
Mm-hmm. And that's completely understandable, considering that Roddenberry and his crew were able to sort of, you know, take a time out, go back to the drawing board, and come back with something that was better.
Yep.
So I think it definitely would have been shocking if people watched The Cage and said, oh my God, this is sure. the best Star Trek ever.
Yeah, that would have been.
Susan yeah. Oliver, Susan as, Oliver yep. as Vina.
Now, if you were to compare pilot to pilot, I definitely think beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Where No Man Has Gone Before is better, much better than The Cage mm-hmm. as far as overall just about everything.
Yeah. So now we have them watching footage on the Enterprise of the Talosians watching footage
of how meta is this. So, you know, footage of footage of footage.
Yeah.
So here we are. We're introduced to the Talosians themselves, mm-hmm. who are the kind of iconic in a way.
Yeah.
The, you know, the pulsing brain head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aliens.
Mm-hmm. All played by female actresses.
Yep. Female actresses. And made to look androgynous because yeah. They didn't want them to look too human.
Mm-hmm.
I think weren't the original aliens supposed to be like crab-like yes. creatures yeah. of some sort? Yeah. And we got the Vina who was born just as they crashed mm-hmm. there. So that's why she's so much younger
yeah.
than the seemingly ancient crashed party here. Really cool old communicator there in Pike's hand. So this is the pre-production props.
Yeah. And I think the doctor, he's speculating that there's something not right at this point, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think so. He kind of reminds me of Burgess Meredith a little bit.
Yeah.
That doctor. He kind of looks a little like it.
Yeah.
So
I'll tell you, a lot of blue eyes on this show over the years. I mean, look at the doctor's got blue eyes and Vina here and mm-hmm. even Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah, Pike's.
All those blue eyes, man.
Piercing blue eyes.
They're popping.
Yeah.
And last episode, Van Gelder had those,
Van Gelder,
those
yep.
blue eyes. Yep. So
now we're gonna see Captain Pike being led off here by the attractive young girl who's gonna show him the secret of how they survived, right?
Yeah, until he gets hit with that magic stick.
Yep. So, you know, this is a really neat set that they built here.
Yeah.
With these rocks and the stairway leading up here. I really like that. For a pilot, this is quite an elaborate set.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually, I think I kind of prefer the set work they did over the on-location stuff, at least in the series.
Yeah.
Yep.
Uh-oh.
And Vina has disappeared, and...
And all of these guys are yep. going to disappear, and out come the Talosians.
And there's that magic
and
stick.
And Bazooya. You know, that kind of reminds me of, did you ever see that Christopher Walken movie, Communion?
No.
So it's the one where Christopher Walken, people are getting abducted by, you know, gray aliens. Walken's
okay,
one
yeah,
of them.
It was the Whitley Stryber
scene,
movie, yeah,
yeah. There's one scene where the alien has like a little poker thing, and it kind of magnetizes to Christopher Walken. So it kind of reminded me of that a little bit.
The author was probably inspired by that
Could
when he
been.
Wrote his true story.
Yeah. Oh, here's the older pilot-style phasers that we do see carried over into some of the actual production episodes. You know, Dr. Crater has one
mm-hmm.
in the Man Trap. So we've seen a couple other ones here. And then they have a rotating front on them to change the power level.
Yeah.
As opposed to the little dial on the top.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
And, man, they are just firing away to result.
And Spock
or
does
no apparent
not
result.
Look happy. Yes, no apparent result. So there we go. And we're back on board watching the events of The Cage unfold. And
now, do you think watching this in a two-part structure, do you think they could have done this in one part if they didn't have if they weren't under a script crunch and they said, hey, we can bust this out in one 50-minute episode?
You know, I have no doubts that they could have.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it would have been as effective.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gives them a lot more room to explore the cage. They'd have to edit it down so heavily,
mm-hmm.
the cage footage itself. Yeah. Plus, I think this, the format of this episode and what's the gravity of the situation of what's going on with Spock, mm-hmm. I think the cliffhanger mm-hmm. break between the two episodes is effective.
Yeah. It almost makes me wonder why they didn't sort of utilize the cliffhanger more.
Yeah.
It's really surprising that over the course of 79 episodes, they only have two episodes that act as a part one and a part two.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, if you look at the way the episodes were written, they're all written by, you know, various writers, you know, and you know, they were shot in a certain order, broadcast in another order. You know, maybe back then, maybe that just wasn't a common concept. Mm-hmm. Maybe it just wasn't one of those things where writers were thinking long term and saying, yeah. you know what, I'm going to flesh this story out more and make it a two-parter. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was something that we don't, maybe something that Roddenberry poo-pooed.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe he didn't like that concept of the cliffhanger type thing. Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing about watching, you know, this show is there really isn't a lot of, there aren't season-long story arcs.
No, there are not.
Where it seems like if you make a show nowadays, there's yep. got to be, you know, you might do your episode by episode stuff, yep. you know, like Law and Order, for yep. example. There'll be, you know, each episode, there'll be a story that they deal with, a case yep. they deal with. But over the course of the season, the characters will have their own little arcs and their own mm-hmm. stories. So it's interesting, and I don't think any of the Star Trek episodes really sort of fell into that, or mm-hmm. any of the series. I know Next Generation didn't really fall into that. They might have had a little bit more focus on season-long development of a character, but it's interesting to think about how Star Trek would work using yep. sort of today's, you know, way to, you know...
Yeah, make, the modern way of yeah. approaching a series. Mm-hmm. So we're ending the episode on essentially Kirk's career is over.
Yeah.
Spock has effectively ended Kirk's career. His plan has seemingly backfired.
And I guess we will join you next week for another exciting entry of the Tricorder Transmissions.
We certainly will. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody.
His condition, he's under observation every minute of every day.
And totally unable to move, Jim. His wheelchair is constructed to respond to his brain waves. Oh, he can turn it. Move it forwards, backwards slightly.
Through the flashing light, he can say yes or no.
But that's it, Jim. That's as much as that poor devil can do. His mind is as active as yours and mine, but it's trapped inside a useless vegetating body. He's kept alive mechanically. Battery-driven heart.